If you really want to understand critical race theory, you have to go back in time.
Their mission was to reestablish white domination, and they did that by monitoring every book in every classroom in the South.
From the African American Policy Forum, I'm your host, Kimberly Crenshaw. This is the United States of Amnesia, a miniseries explaining what CRT really is and what our reaction to it says about America's future. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Immigrantly. I am Sadia Khan. As a host of this podcast, I'm always on the lookout for voices that challenge the status quo and push the boundaries of our understanding of identity and resistance. And I'm so excited to introduce two extraordinary women today whose work does exactly that. Laura Vergara is a dynamic queer Colombian feminist organizer based in Seattle. She's leading the charge in redefining girlhood through stories of girls' resistance, a powerful global initiative that documents the activism of adolescent girls across diverse cultures. Laura's mission is to amplify the everyday acts of defiance that girls undertake against entrenched systems of patriarchy and violence. Ayat Menina, a Libyan researcher and writer based in Toronto, brings a deeply rooted commitment to social justice and storytelling. As one of the 12 curators for Stories of Girls' Resistance and the founder of Shabab Libya, Ayat has played a pivotal role in countering oppression, particularly during the Libyan uprising, where she basically used the power of social media to break through the government's media blackout. How incredible is that? Her activism is really a testament to the power of collective action and the critical role of girls and women in driving social change. And it is incredible to see the power, the agency that girls and women bring to these situations. Both Laura and Ayat's activism is profoundly influenced by their experiences as immigrants. Their vision goes beyond celebrating resistance. Now they imagine a world where girls can live fully and freely, unburdened by the need to fight for their basic rights. What a great vision. By the way, we faced some technical issues on Ayat's side. She is a new mom and hence she was busy with the baby, and also we had some technical auditory issues. But the conversation is incredible. So just bear with us and I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. How are you doing?
You just became a mom, so I'll let you answer first. Well, I guess twice for the second time.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So a lot of sleepless nights?
Yes.
You know, motherhood is such an interesting journey. When you have an infant, you're like, oh my gosh, it's so tough. You have to get up at least a few times at night. But then when that phase passes, you miss it. I miss that phase. My kids are all grown and I'm like, oh my gosh, if I could go back in time.
I know, I'm trying to be present. I'm trying.
And Laura, how are you doing?
Yeah, I think I'm reminding myself to be grateful, to be present. I feel like just a lot happened in this moment. But yes, my mom visiting me, so that's nice.
Oh, nice. It's always good when parents visit, right? My parents are visiting from Pakistan. They are with my sister right now. But before that, they were staying with me. And it was so much fun. Work, but fun.
Exactly.
So, Stories of Girls' Resistance. What a beautiful compilation from across 90 countries, 150 stories. You know what surprised me was that you included stories from the US. I was not expecting that. A lot of times when we think of girls' resistance, when we think of fighting against patriarchy, a lot of people in the Western world don't think about the US. Why did you decide to include those stories? How are those stories different from stories that you covered from across the globe?
I mean, with the stories of girls' resistance, the grounding of it was a framing into first girlhood from girls' voices. And girls are everywhere in the world. And I think a big question that came up in the whole initiative itself is, first of all, why are we talking about girls without girls? And also, why are we dividing girls into these tiny specific boxes that they're actually not in? And that goes the same for girls in the United States, which is a land that has been colonized, where indigenous girl stories have not been told because for so long they attempted to erase them, not just the stories, but the people themselves. I think last week or yesterday was that I was reading that they just found a new school of, which was really a detention camp, concentration camp of indigenous children. And so how many stories do we not know? So I think that the stories of girls' resistance, it was a really deep commitment to tell the stories of all girls resisting everywhere with oppression that is really intertwined and connected.
Hmm.
And so what happens to a girl in the land of Turtle Island, United States, is very connected to what happens to a girl in Central America. So I think that's like a really important part in the effort themselves to hopefully also recognize that if we actually think beyond the structures and boundaries that we've been told, we're able to better transform these systems.
What are some of the through lines or recurring themes that you saw between Indigenous girls in the U.S. versus girls in, say, Latin America?
So I'll highlight the like Black Indigenous girls in both the United States and the Americas, the whole continent, right? It's itself, it's very connected to like Latin America, because if you actually look back at our traditions, they're so similar. I'm from Colombia, and I always find it interesting when I learn more about different practices. And so I would say there's actually a lot of similarities. And Latin America also has a huge Afro-descendant community, just like the United States, for the same reason of how colonization worked.
Hmm.
And I will go first with the really powerful things that go, because I feel like at least my experience, our stories are always told from this, like we have to always be the victims. And I'm really exhausted with that. So I just get really annoyed. So I'll start first with like just the beautiful way in which, despite a really complex context, there's so much joy and play and making sure that that joy is shared with their family and communities. So in Latin America, and I would say like this is a really great connection in the United States, like, I know that story because like it's my story, right? Like, and we share that deeply, where it was like there was a lot of like wars and violence. And in spite of that, the girls will like find ways to play, find ways to get together, have safety. And that's really meaningful. And also they will share with their moms, with their grandmas, with their family, and like create spaces where like they can be held together. In the United States, it was very similar, right? Like in really complex contexts, they will be doing that too. So joy, play as a political act of care is like a really important thread in combination with ancestral practices that are passed on.
When you say political act, what do you mean by that?
The act of depoliticizing has been a huge strategy made by colonizers in order to rip you apart. Depoliticize is to take away your politics, which is really your beliefs or what you stand for. So the act of becoming political and having a political stand is actually recognizing that anything and everything is political, because anything and everything has to do with my views, with what I stand for, with what I believe to be important. And so when we make that grounding, we're actually saying we're not going to be ripped apart from our core beliefs and what we stand for and our opinions and our stances and our framing of the world, but rather that's going to be a central part of how we analyze it. And girls have it, right? Girls want safety. What is more political than safety? Girls want their families to be okay. So all of it is political.
But what you're describing to me seems like inherently important for our existence, right? Safety is an important part of human existence, right? That's something that we want. That's something that we strive for. And when we talk about girls' resistance, I just want to understand within that framework, of girls resisting oppressive and patriarchal systems, they are living their lives. It's like, as you said, it's not about their trauma or it's not about victimization at all. I grew up in a country where as girls and women, we were living our lives. And obviously, there are so many other layers to it, like socioeconomic layers, cultural layers, where you are within that society ethnically. And you may have different experiences, right? Within the same country, girls and women can have very different experiences. Can you share a story from your own life where you first realized that girlhood, as it's often portrayed, didn't really fit your reality?
6 years ago, I was reading a story of this girl. She was from Venezuela and she was around like 15 or so. And she was going to come in to like support us and be working with us. And in her essay that she had of the stuff that she was excited about, she talked about how she missed home and how unfair it was that her family had to flee. And she learned to be like responsible with like money because she had to help her parents out. And also there was a lot that had to do with feeling the insecurities that come from not being home. And there was so many through lines in when I was reading. And then her age, I was thinking she should not be having to think about all these things at 15 and having had that like for a long time, right? And she's so responsible. I was like, oh, I love her. I just want to give her a hug. She's like taking care of her parents. You know, a lot of the times the system will mess up with your parents because they don't know English. And so she'd be like, oh, I'm an excellent translator because I always translate instantaneously for my parents. I'm like, yes, girl, I know what you're doing. And I was just like, oh, and also, no, she had been doing this for so long. And like, I think, you know, what else did she wanted to do with that time and that space? Even though she wouldn't, of course, not wish otherwise, because I know I wouldn't either. But it made me really sit with that. I think, what does that do to our bodies and our heart when we have to grow up?
I feel like for me, it fit my reality because my reality told me that, you know, girls should be a certain way.
What was that way?
For me, it was the earliest perhaps like check on girlhood was about like how to be in public spaces and where girls can and cannot go. And that earliest kind of manifestation of that was like wanting to play soccer in the streets and being told like, no, that's for boys and girls shouldn't be doing that. And you can play indoors or you can play something else or don't play with the boys anymore. So there was this like fork really early on. So it wasn't girlhood was portrayed in a certain way. It was my own kind of innocence or naivety that like I wanted to continue to play how I wanted and then was told, no, it's different now.
Did you question that?
Yes, I was quite stubborn. And I would sneak away and I would play with the boys anyway. But it bothered me that it was like I had to go out of my way to continue to do what I wanted. And I didn't understand the rules. I didn't think they were fair.
And this was where, in Toronto?
No, I grew up in Winnipeg and also I was born in Libya. So I lived there until I was 6. So it definitely started in Libya and then it continued.
At 6?
Yeah.
And I assume those limitations were probably defined by your parents, right?
My parents, my relatives, other adults, like it's the patriarchy. It's everywhere, right?
I want to pivot a little and talk about your curation. So you are one of the 12 curators on this project. And I was listening to one of your interviews where you talk about what the process of curating this was. Can you talk a little bit about that process itself?
Yeah, in terms of the story curation, we were each assigned a region around the globe, and we kind of each set out to collect stories in our own way. So I think probably the overall strategy was to tap into our own respective networks. I will stress that this was a project that we kind of embarked on with a really, you know, kind of tight timeline and a really specific goal in mind. And so obviously, if we were to go back, it could, you know, the stories that we would have collected could have been different or could have been touching on a wider
array of subjects. But the initial kind of push, I think, was really good regardless. We, like you highlighted, we captured so many stories from around the world and tried to keep in mind, you know, what we wanted to lift up. But also there was an element of really not knowing what we were going to get, right? Because this is a very unique set of prompts that we use to interview the storytellers, to ask them about their stories.
Can you share a few prompts?
Yeah, so we really did hone in on, you know, the girlhood. So even if we had interviewed seasoned activists or leaders from various countries, we really asked them to go back into what their girlhood looked like, who were their champions during their girlhood, you know, what were the challenges that they faced, when did their girlhood end? I think that was like a really, really, really important piece that made every storyteller kind of pause. Like some of them probably had to think about that and probably face that in a difficult way. And some others really used the opportunity to reflect during the story collection process.
How are you defining girlhood?
I think that that was quite open from the beginning. We asked them to define what girlhood meant to them, but we really are focusing on time period of birth to adolescence. You know, there's that period of time where there's these really big changes that happen in girls' lives. And a lot of the time, those are, you know, imposed systemically and through society and the challenges that people face in various places that they come from. We really delved into, you know, the start of their girlhood and then how it ended. And then we really looked into, did the end of their girlhood spark some sort of a resistance in terms of them now pushing back? I don't want to generalize, but a lot of the time, like I mentioned, the end is something that's happened abruptly or that's happened against girls wanting to would prefer perhaps to continue their girlhood. Or there's that question of like, can girlhood be indefinite?
So when you say, can girlhood be indefinite, what form or shape will that take?
An indefinite girlhood can be one where each community actually gets to have girlhood actually not be ended, but actually be this continuous journey. And if we think about that too, from a place where girls themselves get to define when is the period that they'll have that girlhood or not, is very different than when it's like because of external forces and systemic injustices. So I would say actually it's open to a timing and framing that is done by people themselves, right? And I think that goes a lot with like autonomy and respecting that. So I would go with that, and like actually that definition of itself, like be led by girls themselves too, right? Which will shift then maybe hopefully in the future or maybe close present. Like when we think about our girlhood, doesn't feel like this detached part of ourselves, but rather inherently our girls are within us in this moment. So like, how do we have that continuous relationship?
So what I'm hearing is, on the one hand, yes, there is a chronological age that defines girlhood in some ways. But at the same time, you're talking about the mindset, right, of being a girl, being carefree, being unencumbered by societal pressures and norms, living your life freely and unapologetically in a way. And that is something that you think people should carry on throughout their lives. Is that an apt summary of what both of you are trying to say in terms of girlhood being indefinite?
Yes, definitely. And I would encourage everyone to dive into the initiative and the book themselves. There's the strategies of resistance. There are the strategies in the ways in which girls are reshaping and transforming the world. And that goes a lot into like play, care, joy, having solidarity, having spaces where they come together and then they strategize. Because usually what ends up happening is that Western countries are just honestly more powerful because of systemic injustices get to decide what girlhood is.
So how do you think the Western world defines girlhood? You said it's different from how other people define it.
I think the way the West defines many of its things is that it has to reflect, you know, the values that the Western world kind of operates in. And a lot of it is kind of capitalism. And a lot of it is very much individualistic. And it's really about isolating, you know, all these different phases and trying to market to them or trying to control them or trying to influence them. And so I think when you think about girlhood in the West, you think about, I feel like it's a marketing blueprint. I think of different, you know, specific colors that are around girlhood or specific activities. That in the West, it's a very small, defined, finite period of in terms of what girlhood is. And it's also one of the least powerful places that you could be in terms of the West. Being a girl is one of the more vulnerable positions that you could be in.
How so?
We kind of exist in the patriarchy, and that those that hold the most powers in the patriarchy are men specifically. And being a girl, being young, being all these other kind of characteristics of being a girl are not deemed important or powerful in the Western culture.
That's an interesting perspective, because in my mind, when I think of how West portrays girlhood, my thought would be girls are more vulnerable in the West because there is a facade that they are in control and they are empowered, which they actually are not. And that dichotomy exists, which makes them more vulnerable because they are not even aware of how patriarchal the society is.
There's definitely, like you said, like a facade or an illusion of perhaps the messaging. You're right that, you know, girls are strong, girls are this or that. But ultimately, who's making decisions for girls, right? It's very rarely girls themselves.
Was there a particular story or a moment that stood out to you as a curator?
We've had a chance to revisit some of these stories recently in light of what's been happening over the last 10 months in Gaza. One of the stories is from a leader in Palestine who, a 70-year-old woman today, and it was really special to hear her story because we were able to see what life looked like under occupation for 70 years and how that impacted her girlhood, how it sparked her resistance, and that kind of intersection between being a girl under a patriarchal system, but also under occupation, under fascism, in conflict. And so to be able to capture that just from essentially, you know, her lifetime was really powerful and kind of sticks out for me in terms of girls' resistance being going hand in hand with, you know, people's resistance and movements and what's really happening on the ground. And that is really intertwined.
That's such an important and beautiful story. You know, as a storyteller myself, I'm always intrigued by how other storytellers view the art of storytelling, right? Because it goes beyond just recording history or telling stories. It actually shapes the future of social justice movements. How do you see your work shaping the future of social justice movements, of lived experiences, basically?
I don't want to kind of fall into the trap of saying like, oh, if we just represent these different voices, then something will happen. Because that's not necessarily the case. I think that's the trap that it will give you the mic, but nothing changes. I think apart from it being a record, like you said, and apart from, you know, trying to represent everybody, I think storytelling also has the responsibility of pushing back against what is, you know, considered dominant storytelling form or mediums, and also kind of just pushing against the traditional ways that we have already developed in terms of what storytelling looks like. I think that there's a lot to be uncovered and a lot to be explored, and just from pursuing storytelling, maybe there's a new way of doing things.
I think storytelling is life. The stories we tell shape the present, the future, and the past. We know that, right? History is a story.
It's not just future. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, it's all of it, all of it. And so I feel like this is actually how we are affirming what we believe in, what's important. And so the stories we tell inherently are also what we hope to be more of. When we look at the history, and I put in quotation marks, of the world, it does not include girls. we have done a lot of research to actually put that right. Like the initiative itself wasn't because it just happened. It was actually because of such a lack and honestly shameful lack. How do we not have stories of girls when they have always existed? They have always done amazing work. And so I think that's really just a big kind of part of like, does the history of the world not have girls? I mean, we know it doesn't have women. We know it doesn't have people of color, Black people, people of different castes, people with disabilities. The stories, even if they're included, they're always told by someone else. So I think then that goes to the reflection. If the stories of the world are only told from this one perspective, we're going to get this exact result. When we look at the world that we have today, so I think that actually the stories we tell will give us the result of the world we have.
So in the end, I always ask my guests to define the United States of America in a word or a sentence. Laura, I'll start with you. And I would really like to know what Ayat thinks as well. I know you don't live in the US, Ayat, but would really like to know what you think. But we'll start with Laura.
I don't want to generalize because when my family and I had to move to the United States, we had to be so grateful. And that was like very forced upon. We had to learn to pledge to the flag, which was the strangest thing. I could not even understand how to say things in English, but here I am pledging to a flag. I had no idea, but I was so scared. So I just didn't, you know, I didn't want us to have to get kicked out. And I remember also meeting a lot of folks in the organizing space that told me, you know, we love the land, not because we own it. We love the land because we're grateful to be in this place. And then that made me a really interesting reframing into what was the United States. And a lot of this were also like indigenous in the United States. And what they said is that it's not because we believe in the system, but because we believe in what it could be and what it was. And so I think the United States is a story that has been told and sold to us. And here we are to reclaim what it actually should be.
Oh, I love it.
No, no, I think right now it's a place that is, you know, fully on display in terms of the cracks and the weaknesses and the challenges and the corruption and the evil it is capable of. Is, you know, there are no illusions right now, I think, but it's up to people to respond accordingly or to reclaim power.
Guys, thank you so much for this wonderful conversation. I'm so glad we were able to do this. So is there a website people can go and check your work?
Yes, we have the Stories of Girls Resistance website, which is girlsresistance.org. And then each regional documentation storytelling effort also has their own. So let's say for Ayat, the region itself has their own living gallery itself and storytelling effort. And so definitely when you go on the website, go into each region, you get to learn a lot more from each one. And we have three books. And I want to highlight to the, especially in this current moment, their Palestinian Stories of Girls Resistance is there and they're all told in their full scope.
Thank you guys. This was wonderful.
Thank you so much.
And I apologize for all of the technical difficulties and the newborn difficulties.
What an incredible conversation. You know what? I think about these things a lot. What does girlhood mean? I have two girls, and these conversations are personal. These conversations are so important. And I think we should have more of these conversations and challenge our own notions of girlhood and maybe revisit our own girlhood. What did it mean to be a girl? What challenges did we face? What were some of the memorable moments that we experienced during our girlhood? And have we been able to extend it beyond those few years? This episode is produced by me, Sadia Khan, written by me. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our sound designer and editor is Hazik Ahmed Farid. Our theme music is by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. Come back next week when I have another important conversation. Take care.